Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ed Wagner, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to pause for a brief moment when I say that I am an alcoholic so that I myself can get the full significance of that which I'm saying. I remember one time the word was quite repulsive. I didn't like it. That was prior to AA. When I came to AA, I admitted the fact that I was an alcoholic. I can't say I was very enthusiastic about it. Later on, it became an opinion with me. As of today, I like to feel that it's a firm conviction. It isn't something that I've been convicted of. It's just a firm belief on my own part that I am an alcoholic, and as one, I have and I am suffering physically, mentally, and spiritually from what I believe to be one of the more horrible, insidious, and very often fatal diseases. A disease that I cannot be cured of, but through the grace of God and AA, which means you people, at least they've shown me how to arrest it by the simple process of doing what Mary so nicely suggested before, not taking one drink for one day at a time. I join with all our friends, neighboring groups, wishing Rogers well. And the fact that they're celebrating the 13th anniversary doesn't mean that the flags are flying, but it does mean that AA is continuing to grow. For over those years, many newcomers have walked in the door. This being a group that were very good practices of the fifth tradition, which suggests that the sole purpose of an AA group is to carry the message to those who suffer, many of us have been able to at least maintain sobriety for a day at a time. I wish on an occasion like this I could just tell you some of the nice things that happened to me since learning of AA, but it wouldn't serve any purpose. The primary purpose of a speaker at an AA meeting is to share their experiences and strength and hope with someone else so that they too may try to solve a common problem. But I couldn't help but thinking before, and I know there's one girl in this room, she's very nervous. She's afraid of what the hell I'm going to say next. Josephine, I'll put you a little at ease. I will tell the people that we over in Brooklyn State sometimes give a speaker 250 plaid stamps if they come and speak. But geez, I thought Joe was a little rough on me when she demanded 750 for me tonight to come here and speak. But I liked her enthusiasm. And when she asked me, you think she was asking me to do a favor? I should have been much more profuse in my thanks to think that even one person would have thought to ask a person to speak at an occasion like this. Unfortunately, I'm not going to tell you anything nice that happened to me. I don't think I'm too different from maybe many of us in the room tonight. I didn't start out in life to become an alcoholic. I was a product of the west side of New York, where if a kid had a nickel and he wanted to keep it, he very often had to be willing to fight for it. And as I grew up, and before I'd gotten out of my teens, on several occasions I'd got into some serious difficulty with the law. I didn't get arrested for intoxication or disorderly conduct. It was always much more serious, and always the aftermath of a drinking party. I didn't think that was particularly unusual of a lot of kids around the neighborhood. My friend Mickey
couple of hundred miles away can think of that because he was a neighbor. We're thinking of you, Mick, by the way.
I didn't think it was too unusual, and I remember starting to keep company with one of the neighbor's daughters, becoming engaged, setting a date to get married. And I remembered the vows that we took that day, though I had had quite a few, I will admit. And I didn't remember hearing the good priest saying anything about raiding a bastardized life with an active alcoholic for 20 years after. That's putting it rather mildly, but that is about the most that I can say my wife got from me. I didn't set off just that way. I realized that running around with the boys, bottle toting, Saturday night drinking, Sunday drinking, wasn't conducive to normalcy as far as married life was concerned. And I think I had all the aspirations and all the ambitions of a young fellow. I wanted to be successful in the work that I was doing. I wanted to have a family. I wanted to have a little security. And I thought they were all good objectives. And I proceeded to do many of the things that I had thought and planned about. And in a reasonable period of time, I was doing fairly well in the work that I was doing. I was making progress. I had a junior executive position when I was in my, just past my mid-20s. God was very good to us. He graced us with 7 wonderful, healthy children. I think I had just about everything that a young fellow could want in life. I have to go back just for a moment to say that knowing that I couldn't carry on as I had before being married, I had heard that it was smart to be continental, that is, to have a few good sherries with your dinner at night. And at that particular time, I was working 14, 15, 16 hours a day, and those few sherries served a very definite purpose. I would come home, past the point of being hungry, past the point of being tired. The first would perhaps relax me a bit. The second stimulate my appetite. And the third would probably help me to get to bed because I had to get up early in the morning again. And between that point and a point that I'm thinking of right now, which might have been a little bit more than halfway down the line, there's a story of complete alcoholic degradation. Those few drinks each night grew to that many bottles each day. The good job that I had, the home, the car, the wife, the children, they're all gone. All. I had a judge lean across a bench, tell me that I was no good to myself, less good to my family, and just stay away from them. That's all he asked me to do. Of course, he did add something else that isn't particularly important. If I didn't, he would have sent me away for a long time. The fact that he told me to stay away from them didn't make me feel bad at the time. I was more interested in drinking than I was in my family. Now, I'm not apologizing for anything that I did while I was drinking. But I would like to say, as a sort of a defensive measure and to show you how one can transform, just a few short years before, again, just a few things in life that were of real importance to me, I no longer would even think about. They meant absolutely nothing. Time wouldn't permit a blow-by-blow, and I don't think it would be particularly good on an occasion like this. But I made my first visit to Kings County Hospital in my late 20s. It's a short visit to the old G building. And on leaving there, I remember too well my brother came to my aid, as he so often had done before. And we got in his car. We got to the Dutchman's on Notron Avenue. It was about 3 minutes. He said to me, "You've had a tough time, kid." He said, "You probably need a drink." I did. Like a hole in the head. And I think he and everybody that knew me for quite a few years thereafter wishes that I'd got the hole in the head instead of the drink. But I promised myself, and I don't think I was ever more honest or more sincere, drunk or sober, that nothing in the world would ever bring me back to Kings County Hospital. And, buddy, I meant it. But for those of you who are alcoholics, even though some of you are just getting tolerance tonight, having to listen to a repetitious story, some of you who are alcoholics could probably pick up my story from there on. You know as well as I do that I went back again and again. I got my B.A. in Kings County, my Bachelor of Alcoholism, in the form of one of those green tickets. I learned what long stays were in places like Kings Park and other state hospitals. And at no time along the line did I ever remember saying to myself, "I'm going to stop drinking. I should stop drinking. I drink too much." At no time. One might say to themselves, how could one who thought at least that they had some common sense be so utterly stupid? Well, I don't think I can even blame the drink for it, but that's just how stupid I was regarding my alcoholic problem. I was willing to admit that I was mental, that I was suicidal, that I was most anything, but I was never willing to admit the drink was my problem. I'd never thought of the word alcoholic, honest to God. I had never thought of it. I thought an alcoholic was a degraded person that was on the Bowery, never worked, never had a family. That was just how I thought an alcoholic was. Up to a point of coming to AA, and of course I can understand Mary. She was attracted there. She had a beautiful blonde one night and a pretty blackhead girl the next night. And I just had Jack Lee Sherry walk in with a big cigar. He isn't a beautiful blonde. He's not a pretty blackhead. But to me, there's only one Miss Sherry in AA. Now, I hadn't asked for AA. I was so filled with self-centeredness and egotism that, believe me, if it only costed a nickel, either I would have had that nickel in my pocket yet or I'd been buried with it. I would never have asked for help. I've learned something from that, too, that I didn't have to wait until a person actually screamed before I would be willing to go and see them. But that particular Sunday morning, I think I had been drinking for some 30, 35, 40 days. I haven't any idea. Around the clock. Day and night, I had to have a bottle if I laid in the bed, if I sat in the chair, no matter where I went. I'd gotten to a point where I couldn't go to the John. And I think I was getting drunk in there more than I was in the living room or the bedroom. Wasn't a matter of wanting to drink, I had to drink. That particular morning, McSherry came in. And he was probably telling me about himself. I will never know because I couldn't hear anything. But I do know that about every 3 or 4 minutes, I would step out of the room because that was just about how long I could go without taking a drink. I would take a quick slug out of the bottle and bounce back in the room again. And after about 4 or 5 such relay races, McSherry took a look at me and says, "Hey, bring the damn bottle in, you'll get bull-legged." I never saw that in the AA book. I never heard it at meetings. They were words of wisdom. For if McSherry told me, "Don't bring the bottle in," chances are I would never have came to AA. But he knew that there was no sense in talking. And he arranged that I go to St. John's Hospital the next morning. Those guys were early risers. They were knocking at my door at 8 o'clock just when I was going out to get my first couple for the day. And after a few days in St. John's, I developed one of the nicest cases of bed rumba that anybody had ever seen in their life. I used to be able to lay on the bed and have my bounces. And after a few days, I ventured up to what I heard them call Duffy's Tavern. And it was there that I sat on the chair, but I actually sat on my hand on the chair so I didn't fall off. And I listened to the conversation that was going on. There were 9 fellows in the room. And they were all cross-sectioned. One was a WPA worker, another was a dental surgeon. It was just a little of everything, I suppose. And all of them had been in AA. All of them. Now, McSherry had been visiting me twice a day, smoking big cigars that had labels on that says, "Easy does it." And I figured, well, by this time, what in the hell would he bring me to a place like that when there was 9 here? And they were all in the thing, and they were in the same boat that I was in. And it was then that I came to the conclusion that he was a male Joe Kirby, and he was getting 40 out of the $75 just to bring me there. But believe me, had I paid $75,000, which I never had and never will probably, I don't think I could have ever gotten more than what I learned in that room and I learned starting that day. But it didn't make any difference how long we were around. One of those fellows, I think he said he'd been sober for 10 or 11 years. I'm not sure. But it didn't make any difference how many times you were, how long you were sober, or how many times you've been hospitalized. It was there that I learned what the first drink was. And it wasn't from a book, and it wasn't just from an individual talking about it. I saw for myself what the first drink meant to people. Then coming to AA, I remember well, I admitted that I was an alcoholic, though I never did before. I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. The people, I loved them. I loved them then the same as I do now. They're the only thing that's important to me as far as people in my life are concerned, other than my immediate family. But I didn't want any part of anything in AA other than the people and the fact that I could learn how to stay sober. Now, I not only admitted it, I think I accepted it. But I like to remember an occasion about after a couple of months after. I was probably unconsciously or subconsciously looking for some defenses or a good reason to take a drink, though I didn't believe it or understand it at the time. When I finally came to one of our more solid members, as I thought of him, and I went up to this big fellow, Joe, and I said, "Well, now, Joe, I can understand how you guys got me sober. You took me to the hospital. You've been nursing me around. You've been taking me to meetings. You call me in the day. You call me in the night. But how do I keep from taking the first drink?" Now, normally, if somebody asked anyone a question like that, they'd probably start talking about the steps and the cliches and all the little things. But Joe knew that even though I'd been around a few months, I was still having trouble counting 12 steps, no less reading them. Joe knew that there was no sense in talking like that. And he simply looked at me this way and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, Ed." He said, "Right now," he said, "if I were you," he said, "I would just ask God each morning to help me to go through that day without taking a drink, and at the end of the day, say thanks to him." Well, I looked up at him, and I said to myself, "You simple-minded son of a so-and-so. I don't even want to talk about God. I don't want to hear his name mentioned. And he's telling me if I don't want, if I want to learn how not to take the drink to do a thing like that. I didn't think that anything he could have said would have been more simple. You know, it was just so simple that it's been working for a few thousand days since. There have been many other things as I went along and as I'm still learning today that I find necessary to do if I want to maintain my sobriety, even for a day at a time. They suggested to me that I shouldn't become opinionated. They also suggested that I should become fully aware of my problem. Unless I understood it myself, I could never do anything about it. Now, they didn't tell me that I should become fully aware of every other alcoholic's problem. They said, become fully aware of your own problem. And then they suggested that attitudes was a very important thing. I find that they are equally important tonight as they were just that many nights ago. And then they told me to set my values. And for that, believe me, it wasn't hard. For myself, I had to get some, in my peculiar way, some thoughts that would help me at the time. Or because for quite a long time, I would walk past the bar or a gin mill. The porter didn't have to come out the next morning. My tongue went down, cleaned his whole damn sidewalk, and everything was all right. He had nothing to do the next day. I didn't want to take a drink consciously, but those things were happening. And they told me that, don't worry about it, that that too would pass. And I like to thank God that now as I look past the same gin mill, he had to sweep something else off the next day. And I look in, and I don't have any admiration for anybody sitting there at 9 a.m, as I so often did, trying to read the times when I could have trouble reading even the weather part of it. But I thought it made me look influential, I guess, and I thought I would like to sit with a newspaper like that. But I've learned to set my values at least up until tonight, and I know that tonight I can exercise the God-given choice of taking a drink if I want to. But I have to remember that if I want to take that drink, that I have to be willing, ready and willing, and want to take everything that goes with it. Perhaps I'll just mention a few of the little incidents that I like to keep very clear in my mind. I don't ever want to forget them, not for a minute. They don't bother me, because I bargained with God. I asked him to do one thing, just to take the load off my shoulders, each day that I didn't take one drink. And he's carried out his part of that bargain pretty well. But I've also added that if I did take a drink, put it back on twice as heavy. And knowing what I was carrying before, I know I couldn't carry it again. Twice as much would be impossible. I like to think my last drink was my last chance. I like to think of just a few little incidents, a point that perhaps was maybe a little past the halfway mark without any particular provocation. And again, I'll apologize, not actually, but to you who have heard the story over again, if nothing else, you'll get a little tolerance tonight. Without any particular provocation or any trouble with my wife, I told her to get up from a chair that she was sitting on. By this time, I think I had been drinking for 1 month, 2 months, I don't know just how long, day and night too. And I took a shotgun out from under the cushion of the chair. I pointed it at her head and told her to say a prayer that it would be the last time that she would say them. Now, she could run the 100-yard dash up those stairs in a little less than 2 seconds lower than the world champion at the time. She'd had a lot of experience. She used to barricade herself up in the upper part of this one family house with the children. But she had a relay system set up with a neighbor, and they very nicely used to call 105th Precinct. They were very obliging there. They always sent a couple of radio cars, never just one, and always double manned. And this particular night, they done that as they so often had done before. And it wasn't very difficult for me to convince those cops to take a look at my wife. I think it was just a few minutes before she bore her 7th child. Take a look at her. She's neurotic. I'm going hunting in Pennsylvania the next day. That's the reason for the shotgun on the house. It wasn't at all hard for me to convince those cops that that was the story. In fact, so much so, the two of them come back to this particular gin mill that I had just left shortly before, and they continued to drink with me, and they felt very sorry that a nice guy like me should have a wife like I had, really. I mean, and now, my wife has got a pretty good sense of humor, believe me. It's not perverted like mine. She's got a good sense of humor, and she can laugh at these things today. But I've often wondered, I still do, how you or I would like to have been on the other end of that shotgun that night with a suicidal maniac on the other side of it. I can be very honest with you, I love my wife. But the barrel of that damn shotgun had no way of communicating a message like that. You see, they're the things that I can have back in my house tonight, or any other night that I decide I want to take a drink. But when I reach out and take that drink, I've got to want everything that goes with it. I can think of a little girl, and I'm not exactly a stranger here. All my seven children went to this school here, and we graduated from this school, and a couple of them were married here. But I can think of one little girl when she was about 10. And she stood up one night and she screamed, "Daddy, I hate you." And she did with all the hate and venom that a child can hate a father, and Lord knows they can too. And I would just like to say, I've never asked her forgiveness. I've never asked her not to hate me. I've never asked for her respect or her regard. Believe you me, she doesn't hate her daddy today. I remember walking down the aisle again in the same church with her. She didn't hold me with one hand, she held me with two hands. And I knew there was a message there. She didn't have to say it to me. But it's one of the things that, to me, that if I never drew one other sober breath as long as I lived, or if the next breath that I took was the last one, it would be well worthwhile just a little thing like that. But they are the things that I can have back in my house any night I want them. All I have to do is reach out, take a drink, or even want to take a drink. And I must know that if I do, that I've got to want that which goes with it. Or I could think of another day riding around Flatbush here with my wife in a taxi cab. She looked like a U-bangie. She had a lip. Makes me nausea when I even think of it yet. Just a lip like that. I don't remember how she got it. She does. From loan office to loan office, trying to get 100 to pay 100. I can have that back in my house anytime I want. All I have to do is want a drink. Or I could perhaps think of the last time leaving a hospital, St. John's that I mentioned before. Jack took me home on a Saturday. My two boys then, the older two boys, had grown up pretty well. They were no longer the little kids that used to look up at their daddy and say, "Daddy's still sick, Mommy, having more medicine." They were a little past that stage. They were getting to be pretty big boys. And those two fellas were laying. I got home from the hospital about 5 o'clock on a Saturday. And by 6 o'clock, they were laying 5-1 with a neighbor that I'd be drunk before Sunday. Now, if I had any money, I'd sure as hell bet their way, for I had never seen a sober Sunday for as many years as I could remember before. But I would also like to think that neither of those boys, or their brothers or sisters, were particularly sorry that they haven't had to pay off on that debt,
at least up until tonight. So the next night, I took a 17-inch knife out from the pillow of one of those boys. Now, I've never had any trouble with the children. I think I had the graces of God long before AA. Never put my hands on them. I guess unconsciously I knew that I would have killed one of them just as quick as I would have killed anyone else. That's why I think it was the grace of God. But when I took that 17-inch knife from out from the pillow of that boy, I knew then, but I know more clearly now, he sure as in hell didn't have it under his pillow to clean his fingernails. And that I also know that my father, whom I never knew of to take a drink, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to his memory, he could never have stood on an AA platform and told you that he'd done for my mother what I'd done for the mother of those boys. He would never have lived to tell us. That could happen in my house. My house isn't the only house for an alcoholic. The only way it can happen is for my wanting it to happen and thinking that if I take a drink, or just to think that I could or should take a drink, that I have to want things like that to happen. And I could go on for hours on end. Everything I would tell you would probably be just a little bit more degrading than the things before it. I haven't became angelic since I've come to AA. I'm not looking to. I don't think I'd look good with a halo. I have bursitis. I wouldn't want to sprout wings. But AA has taught me to try to be just a little bit better today than I was yesterday.